This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on our virtual radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And today, on a cold February day, we're going to talk about something that might sober us up a bit, make us think hard about the environment we live in and, you know, the practices that we have. We're going to talk with Michael Osterholm. He's the director of the University of Minnesota Center for Infectious Disease Research and Prevention. And a week ago today, he was giving some testimony at the Minnesota Capitol about chronic wasting disease. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
You said last week it is probable that human cases of chronic wasting disease associated with the consumption of contaminated meat will be documented in the years ahead. It is possible that the number of human cases will be substantial and will not be isolated events. That is, that's attention-getting.
Well, unfortunately, it is the truth, and it's where we sit today. For me, it's almost like a deja vu moment. Back in 1986, when BSE was first documented infected bovine in England, again, BSE being bovine spongiform encephalopathy, a prion-related disease in cattle, as opposed to what we see currently in deer and elk. And people basically kind of stepped back largely and said, well, this isn't going to infect humans. And then, of course, the first cases were diagnosed in 1996, 10 years later, and the terrible mad cow disease situation unfolded in England and certain other European countries. I think today our concern is that there is enough information that this prion-mediated disease in the white-tailed deer population and elk are, in fact, the potential source of a similar type of disease in humans that we saw with that situation in England.
Well, let's back up a bit for our listeners and just lay some groundwork here. What is chronic wasting disease?
Well, chronic wasting disease is a neurologic disease, meaning it affects the nerves and the brain and so forth of these cervids, which are include deer, elk, reindeer, et cetera. And the prion is a type of almost inert chemical, meaning it's not really infectious in the sense of growing. But when this particular chemical structure gets into an animal body or a human body, it can, in fact, then cause changes, particularly in the brain, that then result in almost like a dementia picture, in a sense, in deer. It is just that, a chronic wasting disease where they die. And we know that prions are very hardy in the sense that even though they're not alive, they can remain in the environment for many, many years. They're resistant to much of our current disinfection approaches. For example, they can withstand temperatures up to 1,600 degrees. And so it's a real challenge to try to stop this transmission. Chronic wasting disease is a disease we know actually started in western United States, actually in Colorado in 1967, but has now spread to at least 24 states and two provinces, largely through the movement of cervids, deer and elk primarily, through game farm systems from state to state, and then with inadequate fencing and follow-up, the animals either got out and then had contact with the wildlife of that area or some of the wildlife, the deer and elk, actually got into the game farms because, again, the fence problem. And once the prion was introduced into an area and got into the wildlife population, particularly white-tailed deer, it moved very quickly.
So how is the disease transmitted? Are the deer eating something that has these prions on it?
Well, it's probably saliva is the number one contact. So when deer are basically clustered up together and in close contact, then at that point transmission can occur. We know that these prions are in the environment. We know that they can be in soils, they can get incorporated into plants. How infectious that kind of situation is, we don't know, meaning not direct contact with an infected animal. But I think the bottom line is that we just have to be prepared for what could be a spread of the prion from the animals to the humans.
I recall this showed up in some farm-raised elk in Minnesota some years ago. How prevalent is it in animals that are hunted in Minnesota, in our part of the upper Midwest?
Well, right now, the state of Wisconsin basically is a disaster zone in terms of what's happened. We have some counties there, Iowa County, Wisconsin, where now we see up to a third of all the white-tailed deer infected. Here in Minnesota, we have a situation where we have had it introduced in, and in two instances with very aggressive activities by the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, the increased killing of harvesting of the deer in that area, targeted removal by sharpshooters, et cetera, actually appeared to have stopped the ongoing transmission. However, now in southeastern Minnesota, we really have a problem down there, primarily in Fillmore and Houston counties, where, again, we have every evidence that farmed cervids brought it into the area. They then, because of the fact they got out of their farm areas, then had contact with the native white-tailed deer and started a transmission change there. So at this point, we're very concerned here in Minnesota about that area down there.
Now, at this point, my understanding is that chronic wasting disease has not yet shown up in humans, but this mad cow disease outbreak that you referenced in Britain, there were this kind of variant that showed up in people called, what, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease?
That's the name of it in humans. Actually, it's called variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease relative to the bovine spongiform. Bovine spongiform encephalopathy was the disease in the cattle, BSE. And this is a very similar kind of picture.
But this is an extremely rare disease, isn't it?
It is rare relative to a natural occurrence. Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease occurs in the healthy population at a very, very low rate, 1 to 2 per million population. But on the other hand, when you have the animal source, such as we saw with BSE, there have been over 200 cases of this in England and Europe related to eating the contaminated meat from the beef at that time. Here we have no evidence yet of transmission into humans from the chronic wasting disease prion. The challenge we have is that by the time we would pick that up, it could be many years after you're exposed. So somebody getting exposed today might not show any symptoms for 5, 6 to 10 years. And that by the time those symptoms show up, people recognize what's happening, we've had a lot of people exposed. And so one of the issues we raised is that we don't know if this is going to result in transmission. I wouldn't want to bet against it. In that light, then, what can we do to improve the safety of venison consumption? And one of the things I testified last week is that we can go a long, long ways in doing that by making certain that the animals are tested before they're actually consumed. So once a deer is shot, then at that point it's rapidly tested. The testing results come back quickly, and the individual hunter knows whether or not there's a problem. A second area that's really important is because these prions are so hardy, meaning it's virtually impossible to disinfect them effectively, you don't want an infected carcass going into a meat processing plant where it'll be mixed and mingled with lots of other deer and other meat sources and contaminating the equipment. And so at that point, that's also a real challenge for us.
Well, as I recall, and this is more than 30 years ago now, this bovine spread mad cow disease basically destroyed the English cattle market for some time. Is there some concern given the time of that you have to be exposed to this in humans that we might already have people who are carrying this?
We don't know. There really could be. And the problem is we won't know until they exhibit the classic signs and symptoms and then additional studies showing that, in fact, this is what they have. But again, that would mean many years between when they started getting infected and when they show symptoms. Well, that's what we call an incubation period. And we know that it surely can be at least 10 years before people who are infected actually show the first signs and symptoms, meaning, as you pointed out, those entire 10 years, you might very well have ongoing transmission from animals to humans. So again, we think the common sense approach here is just to take the precautions as if it might be happening. And this is really important in part because we're seeing such a very rapid expansion in the number of deer that are positive in wild area or in the wildlife population. There's one group that has done a fair amount of work with this, and they recently estimated that anywhere from 7,000 to 15,000 chronic wasting disease positive animals are being consumed annually.
Wow.
And so, you know, we have a grand experiment going on right now, which we don't need to have happen if, in fact, these animals were tested. Now, one of the challenges we have is, again, we have a number of people who are coming forward saying, well, you know, I've been eating chronic wasting infected deer for years, and nothing's wrong with me yet. And that may very well be true, but they don't know that they're not infected now with one of the prion strains that actually can be a real problem. So I think at this point it's really difficult to counter some of these arguments because we don't have any cases. But that's our whole goal, is to make sure we don't.
What would the symptoms be if this were to show up in humans? Do you know?
Well, in many cases, it tends to show up almost like Alzheimer's in some ways. You know, there's a number of neurologic symptoms that kind of come together to form that constellation of symptoms with that illness. So I think that this is one of the areas we really need a lot of research on to understand, you know, what might it look like? What did BSE look like when it went from cattle to becoming Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease? And, you know, what are the test methods we have today that will allow us to know that? So that's the challenge we have.
Well, is it possible that there are people who are exhibiting these symptoms now? It's been misdiagnosed because it isn't
known. We don't have any evidence of that yet, but I think that's one of the things we want to really be very, very careful about and make sure that we, you know, are doing active surveillance in states. Each state that has potential chronic wasting disease in its deer or elk populations, we really want to work on that to make sure that we're picking up any of those potential cases if they occur.
If deer kind of get these prions through saliva sharing or whatever, wherever they're feeding, is that a mode of transmission for humans possibly?
Well, we haven't seen that so far. We don't have evidence of person-to-person transmission like that.
Mm-hmm.
We did have some initial evidence in England that before certain steps were taken with the blood supply, that there may have been a few cases where blood transfusion from an infected individual, unknowingly infected, to a susceptible individual occurred, and that was when transmission occurred.
So these prions can accumulate in the body over time. Are there other possible sources of prions under research?
And really, it's you know, it's an animal or human individual that's going to be the source. Again, I pointed out before, these prions, once in the environment, surely survive. They persist. And it's a matter of still doing the studies to find out, but is this the source for other animals or for humans? And we really don't have any data on this at this point to comment one way or the other on that.
Well, considering the kind of thing this prion, is there possibly some defense, or is that an area of research right now?
Yeah, in fact, there's very little defense at all, just given the unique nature of it, other than the fact that test your product, meaning make sure that any potential venison you're going to eat was tested as soon as possible after it's been harvested and before it ever gets into another population. So, meaning you're not eating venison from a deer that's infected and getting into humans, or it's not being fed to other animal species. So that's what we have to really concentrate on now.
How long have you been concerned with this?
Well, I've been concerned for some time because, of course, I lived through and actually had some involvement with the BSE activity back in England in 1986, and I watched many of the same arguments. Oh, don't worry about it. We don't have any cases now. It's not a problem. And in fact, you may recall a very famous PR shot from the leader of the agriculture department in England. Actually took his grandkids out one day early in the animal outbreak and had them eat hamburgers for the public to see. You know, now in retrospect, we realize, you know, how irresponsible that was. I think based on that, we've all worried that could this happen where you're going to see human transmission from consumption of this contaminated venison. And I think the challenge we have now is that the numbers are growing rapidly, and the potential for many, many more people to be exposed just raise the specter that, in fact, the chances of seeing cases are going to get higher also.
Mike Osterholm is the director of the University of Minnesota Center for Infectious Disease Research and Prevention. Mike, do you eat venison from deer hunts?
You know, I don't, but it's not because I have not decided to. It's just I haven't had access to it.
Okay.
I'm a fisherman, a dyed-in-the-wool fly fisherman. I just haven't hunted for a number of years. But I wouldn't eat venison today from an infected area, meaning an area where we know the prions exist, without having it tested first.
And you've mentioned southeast Minnesota and parts of Wisconsin, lots of Wisconsin,
right,
as a
right.
matter of fact.
And Iowa, we're seeing it, yeah, throughout a number of areas of the Midwest.
Is chronic wasting disease research a priority for your center now?
We're working on that. Right now, no one really seems to have primary responsibility. It kind of falls through the cracks, As a wildlife disease, the wildlife folks obviously deal with it, but they don't deal primarily with human disease or potential. At the places like the CDC and so forth, it really doesn't fit into any one category there. And so it has been a challenge trying to provide leadership, and our center, therefore, has kind of stood up this activity, and we're doing what we can to help provide, current comprehensive and authoritative information on it.
Well, every year we talk about flu outbreaks, and of course now we're talking about measles outbreaks in parts of our country. How would you compare this emerging issue to other infectious disease threats?
Well, I wrote a book a little over a year and a half ago called Deadliest Enemies, Our War Against Killer Germs, which I tried to lay out a framework for how we look at infectious diseases, because far too often that which kills us versus that which really concerns us versus that which scares us are all very different, and we need some framework. So in the case of the potential for CWD to be transmitted to humans, all it would take is a few cases, and I think you'd spark a hell of a panic. And people would actually consider not hunting anymore, which then again would only accentuate the problem in the white-tailed deer, because as the population increases, the more likely there's going to be contact between animals that would transmit this. So clearly, deer hunting is a very important part of the control measures. And I think that in that regard, you would see, like you saw with BSE in England, even a few cases, a couple hundred cases, would have much, much more public impact than, 1,000 cases of measles. Now, I don't want to minimize one case of measles as a problem, and we should be preventing it with our vaccination programs. But at the same time, I think that things that are exotic, things that happen like BSE and from cattle meat consumption, or should we see chronic wasting disease prions transmitted to humans, I think that would become a front page story day in and day out for some time.
Sounds like you're concerned about a negative effect on Minnesota's deer hunting tradition and industry because they help maybe mitigate this.
They actually do. This is very important. And this, anything we do today has to be done working with hunters. Very important. Very, very important.
Now, one common use of venison from the hunt is to make it into sausage. Should we be more concerned about certain kinds of deer meat?
Well, I think that's one of the challenges I just talked about earlier is that when you make sausage, that means you go through meat processing. And the question is, did somebody's deer just ahead of you come through the system that was positive?
Yeah.
And, in fact, did they now contaminate the equipment? So the meat that you're eating, even if it were from a source that wasn't contaminated, it might very well be contaminated now.
Well, this is a very interesting and a story that I'm sure we'll be following, and I know you are.
Yeah.
Mike Osterholm is the director of the University of Minnesota Center for Infectious Disease Research and Prevention. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next on Main Street, a Plains Folk essay from Tom Ezer.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel in downtown Fargo, featuring the Cityscape Ballroom for weddings with a view overlooking downtown. And spaces for bridal showers, rehearsal dinners, and gift openings. More information is available by calling the Radisson at 701-232-7363.
Cupid, draw back your bow. Those fun candy conversation hearts may be no more, but this Valentine's Day, you can still send some of the organizations you believe in.
A message of love.
And we hope one of them is Prairie Public. This February 14th, Prairie Public is participating in Giving Hearts Day, the largest 24-hour online giving event.
The number of the day is a lot of fun.
Count yourself as a supporter of public media by going to givingheartsday.org. All contributions of $10 or more, up to $5,000, will be matched thanks to the Newman's Own Foundation.
The real cool hand.
So say, count me, and give to worthy organizations that reflect your values on Giving Hearts Day this Valentine's Day.
Thank you for listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. As you just heard, it's Giving Hearts Day across the region. This day of giving has grown by leaps and bounds over the years, with hopes that it will continue to grow this year. We're especially pleased to be among the hundreds of nonprofits eligible for support during the 24-hour event. If you go to prairiepublic.org and click on Giving Hearts Day, your donation of $10 or more will be matched dollar for dollar by Newman's Own Foundation. We are very thankful for that support and the generosity of our listeners. We're also thankful for historian Tom Easern, who shares his writing and his voice on Main Street every week with his Plainsfolk essays. Today, Tom's piece is titled Mighty Hunter.
A few days ago, I was honored to take part in an homage to our great poet, Tim Murphy, who crossed over last summer. He went bravely and willingly, flying free of disability and pain. I remember the moment when I learned of his passing. You see, Tim has a distinct place in my book, Pacing Dakota, reflecting the place he has come to hold in our household. Notice here that I continue to speak of him in the present tense. I've written about Tim as a kindred spirit, representing our generation of the late 20th century on the plains, dispossessed, the too-much-mistaked generation of a land unpeopled, but a cohort whose survivors have found voice and are writing like never before. I suspect, I wrote last year, that most people who knew Tim in 2000 would be surprised he is still alive today. He is, in fact, at the height of his powers, writing his fool head off. His generational peer, I find myself writing more and accomplishing more than in any other period of my life. And then, as I sat with the page proofs of my book in my lap, came word Tim was gone. I confess I muttered a coarse phrase, then asked forgiveness. Now, here is how I feel about the coincidence of Tim's passing while embedded in my forthcoming book. Because of this, I have rendered him forever in the literary present rather than the historical past, a living presence forever. Let me give you a stanza from Hunter's Log 2 and 3, just published posthumously by North Dakota State University Press. Here, Tim remembers one of the great hunting dogs of his life. Feeney, when you are gone, I'll just let go. We've had enough of hunting in the snow. I thank you for your 2,000 birds, and thank you for some 100,000 words. We've been collaborators on poetry. Verses were lurking under every tree. Writers are generally talkative souls and somewhat full of themselves, and they like to tell Genesis stories about their work. The question an author most likes to be asked is, where did the idea come from for this book? The author has a ready answer, full of details as to physical circumstances and thought progressions, sometimes even divine inspirations by which the great work precipitated. In stereotypical Genesis stories, there is a dark and stormy night and a bolt from the sky. Well, I never heard a Genesis story from Tim about Hunter's Log. In my last recollection of him, he was propped up on his deathbed, asking for help to scroll his computer screen so that he could finish one more damned sonnet. My careful reading of Hunter's Log says it was an incremental work, a journal both reflective and playful, that accomplishes what poetry of the land and its people should do for the land and its people. Integrate the palpable and sensate experiences of life into something deeper, something, I dare say, spiritual. The Genesis of Hunter's Log I had to find for myself, literally, in the book of Genesis, Genesis 10:9, to be precise. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord.
That's Tom Easern. Coming up on Main Street, Chuck Lura tells us about the great backyard bird count in his Natural North Dakota essay. Sue Balcom offers some breakfast ideas for Main Street Eats. And we'll look at our What's Happening calendar of things to do. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The constitutional measure to expand the State Board of Higher Education to 11 members has a few other changes. That measure is sponsored by the Senate majority and minority leaders. The bill extends the terms of board members to 6 years, and board members will be able to serve two non-consecutive terms. One of the other changes concerns the structure of the nominating committee for the board members. That committee is made up of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Speaker of the House, President Pro Tem of the Senate, and the head of North Dakota United.
Chief Justice Vandewall, or the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, said that that was a conflict of interest and needed to be taken out of the Constitution. So we've removed that name and added the Secretary of State as the replacement member.
Senate Minority Leader Joan Heckman says the measure also removes the requirement that the Senate has to confirm the board members.
The Senate approval process that goes right now to advise and consent is basically a rubber stamp because most of these members take office on July 1st, and we don't approve them until January or February, and it's just sort of a formality.
If the measure passes the legislature, it would go to the voters in 2020. Officials with Altru Health Systems in Grand Forks will be adding air support to their regional services. Altru CEO Brad Weehy says the Altru Care Flight service is expected to begin April 1st. The air ambulance will operate out of the Grand Forks Regional Airport using a Pilatus PC-12 fixed-wing aircraft.
As we researched aircraft and worked with folks, we believe that that is, I don't know, the safest, most progressive way to transport patients, and have done a lot of analysis as far as not only safety, but just cost effectiveness and how, you know, speed of a transfer, comparing that to helicopter services and such, and really landed on this particular aircraft and are excited to invest in it for the region.
Weehy says even with the airplane located outside of Grand Forks, it has advantages over a helicopter.
Generally, when you look at the overall speed and weather and travel range and those types of things, it very much outweighs that single benefit of a helicopter. So when we looked at it, we feel that ground connection along with a fixed-wing transfer is just faster in general than a helicopter transfer, and it's just very efficient, it's very safe, and probably more cost-effective for patients.
Weehy says the cost is always a factor. He says overall they anticipate the aircraft will be a benefit to the hospital and for the region. And a rural Glendon, Minnesota couple had quite a surprise on Tuesday night when a small package was delivered to their home. Clay County Sheriff Mark Emting says the mailing address was not correct.
Kind of somewhat vaguely to that address, but not the exact address. And they opened up the card and they found some suspicious packaging inside there that had a white powder to it. They didn't know what it was. They didn't open it any further, which was very good, very fortunate for them. And it turns out that it was some fentanyl.
The small plastic baggie inside the card contained more than 1,200 lethal doses of the opioid. Exposure to the small amounts of fentanyl can be lethal for most people. Emting says investigators are now trying to track down who mailed the card containing the drug and who it was intended for. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Maury and Kathy Schwinden, encouraging everyone on this Giving Hearts Day to find a charity or several you can love and support. Your donation at givingheartsday.org is the response of a giving heart.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura is a naturalist. He loves to tell us about the plants and animals and phenomena that we can see if we look carefully around us where we live. Today, his Natural North Dakota essay asks us to literally go outside and experience the great backyard bird count.
I was looking at the range map of the Northern Raven in one of my bird guides recently. The book is several years old, but the range of the species does not include any part of North Dakota. I'm not sure about the rest of the state, but not so many years ago, seeing a raven in the Turtle Mountains would have been a rarity. These days, I see about as many ravens as crows up here. Many species are often on the move, whether they be birds, mammals, insects, plants, or others. Their ranges may be shifting, expanding, contracting. It makes one wonder what's going on. We generally give little consideration, but the many range maps we check in all those field guides are based on various forms of documentation. Much of this work is done by biologists, and that's important work. It helps us better document the distribution of a species. Any changes in their distribution may help scientists better understand the biology and ecology of the species and may involve aspects of habitat, food availability, climate change, and other factors. Increasingly, citizen scientists are making significant contributions in documenting the distribution of species, particularly for birds and some insects. There are at least two citizen science efforts on behalf of monarch butterflies. Monarch Watch and Journey North are perhaps the best known of the monarch butterfly efforts. If your interest is in birds, there's also the Audubon Society's Christmas Bird Count, which is a concerted effort to count birds in an area during one day in December or January. There is also Project Feeder Watch. From November through April, observers periodically survey the birds in an area such as feeders and backyards. And we have a great citizen science project coming up soon. The Great Backyard Bird Count will run from February 15th to the 18th. It's an effort headed by the Cornell University Lab of Ornithology and the National Audubon Society to better understand the movements of birds across North America during the 4 days in February. Participating is easy. You just count the birds in your area for at least 15 minutes for as many of the days as you like. Count the greatest number of individuals of each species you see together at any one time. Then, when you're finished, submit your results. If this citizen science project is of interest to you, check out their website at birdcount.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
On this week's North Dakota Legislative Review, we'll talk with Democratic Senator Larry Robinson of Valley City. He's a longtime member of the Senate. He's a member of the Appropriations Committee and has looked into the IT situation. So join us for Legislative Review, coming up Friday at 6:30 p.m. Central, 5:30 p.m. Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and in our Bismarck studio, root seller Sue Balcom, because it's time for Main Street Eats.
Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You want to talk about healthy breakfasts. Get the day off on the right foot.
Right, because as we all know, it's January, and we all probably indulged a little bit in December with all our Christmas parties. And so naturally, it's starting to get light. Like, I can already see an extra hour of daylight. People are starting to wake up and think, oh, good, what can I do today? Well, you can start your day off with some healthy breakfast, because breakfast is the most important meal of the day.
And I wake up hungry.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
I also go to bed hungry and spend most of my day hungry. And I eat all the time.
That's why we're always talking about food. It's the next best thing to eat in all day long, right?
It's true. But it can be hard to want to have a healthy breakfast sometimes. Because when you just need to eat, like, immediately when you wake up.
I know, right? So what do you grab? You grab something like a donut or a bagel on your way to work, when a little pre-planning will go a long way. Like, I've discovered overnight oats, or muesli, which is a Swedish oatmeal. They don't cook their oatmeal.
Right.
They soak their oatmeal in things like honey and yogurt. They add cinnamon, vanilla. You can add other kinds of seeds. But what you want to do is you want to get your little canning jar out, a pint canning jar, or if you're like me, maybe a half a quart canning jar would work. I mean, a quart jar, half full or full. anyway, I love oatmeal. My husband was in the service, and he hates oatmeal. I said, that's because you've never had real oatmeal.
Oh, yeah. Get the good steel-cut ones.
Oh, my gosh, yes. And if you don't want all that grit, then definitely at least use half and half. Half rolled oats, never instant. We never use instant oatmeal at our house. But rolled oats and then the steel cut, which you can get in bulk at most grocery stores nowadays. But, you know, you put your 3/4 cup of oats in there, add a couple tablespoons of flax seeds, put a teaspoon of honey in there, maybe some vanilla, absolutely cinnamon, because as you know, honey and cinnamon are two things that are very, very good for you. And then fill it up with milk and let it sit overnight in the refrigerator. And then on your way out the door, grab it and go. And it's wonderful, and it's hearty, stick-to-your-ribs kind of food. If you want to heat it up, you can do that too. You can microwave it when you get to work and eat it warm. But I love it cold myself.
Does it matter much if you're using all steel-cut oats? Do you need to increase your liquid or time or anything?
The overnight thing will work with the oats no matter what, but you may want to add a little more liquid. You know, it depends on how you like your oatmeal. You could actually just use water if you have this lactose intolerance, or if you just plain old don't like milk. Orange juice would work, but you'd want to experiment a little bit. I like mine pretty thick, whereas somebody else might like them runny. My boss eats his oatmeal with ice cream and maple syrup in the morning.
Ice cream, huh?
Yeah. He said it melts into the oatmeal and it gets just wonderfully creamy. So there you go.
I think he eats ice cream with a little oatmeal, not the other way around.
Maybe. You can always add berries. You know, I buy all kinds of berries in season during the summer and freeze them for use in the wintertime. So you can add, like, on your way out the door, if you want to add a handful of frozen blueberries or strawberries or bananas to the top of your oatmeal. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to work, if you put it, do you remember those radiator meals or? Remember that back in the day
wrapped
when
wrapped it in tin foil?
Yeah, and you put it on your manifold, and it would be cooked by the time you were ready for lunch.
We called those tin foil dinners, and actually, as a Boy Scout, you put it on the campfire embers. But I suppose you could put it on the manifold of the car if you seal it really well.
Right. So by the time you get to work, you could have hot oatmeal if that's what you want. So I wouldn't recommend doing that because fumes. You know,
you might have to chip it off the engine block. Yeah. But what if you aren't running out the door and you do like something hot in the morning?
Actually, I have done a lot of research on the difference between women's metabolism and men's. And one of the things they really recommend for women is to actually eat eggs in the morning. So breakfast tacos, which, like you said, if you have a few minutes, you can cook a couple eggs with a little bit of whatever you had left over from dinner last night. Let's say you have some chicken breast left over, or you have some sausage left over, turkey or wishik or otherwise. Get your ingredients in the pan, like turkey, a little bit of onion, a little bit of green pepper if you want. You can pour your eggs over that. Just beat them up with a little bit of water. Pour that over there. Add some cheese, some chopped avocado. Roll it up in a tortilla. Put it in your tin foil or wax paper recyclable wrap. And take that to work with you. They're good at room temperature. If you really, 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 really have a lot of time, or you think about this the night before, you could cook up some bacon and throw some bacon in there because we all love bacon.
Yes,
you know.
We do.
But eggs are really good for you. If you have the chance to try a farm egg, I would recommend that because they really have lots of wonderful flavor.
One of my favorite things to add to a breakfast taco, too, is refried beans, or sometimes I'll just even get like that 7-layer chip dip and then just put all 7 layers.
I've never tried that.
It's a really cheap.
You should try ice cream with oatmeal.
But, you know, speaking of, you know, south of the border, omelets are a wonderful thing, too. You know, green onions and spicy meat and mushrooms and chilies and chopped tomatoes and all that kind of good stuff in an omelet, which you can make with or without the yolks. You know, there are some people that prefer egg white omelets. We like the real deal at our house. And, of course, making omelets is so easy. I think it's actually one of the first things that they teach students now in home ec is how to make an omelet, which is simply butter up a cast iron pan if you got it and whoop up some eggs, and you can add whatever you want. Like I said, if you're using things like if you have, let's say you had chili for dinner the night before, oh my gosh, cook those eggs, throw some chili and cheese in there and roll it up and you have like a fabulous omelet. And breakfast, you should never think of breakfast as pancakes, eggs, toast, waffles. Breakfast can be anything you want to eat.
I think sometimes people, when they're making omelets, are a little intimidated by they want to make it the perfect omelet. They don't flip it just right.
Just
mix it up there. Get it in there. Get it hot. Eat it.
Eat scrambled eggs, guys.
That's exactly right. We're not winning any contests here, and we don't have Hell's Kitchen looking over our shoulders. So just make it look as fluffy or as crazy as you want.
Well, we got about a minute left, and smoothies are another great option here for just throw stuff in a blender and make it good, and a great way to sneak in some breakfast greens. Put the spinach, put the kale.
Absolutely, and I have a bullet. I think most of us get things like that for Christmas, a NutriBullet. And I'll tell you what, in the summertime in particular, every day. So I learned this little trick just recently that I'll share with you. Smoothies can be made out of just about anything. I freeze all my brown bananas so that I can use them in smoothies. But you can do this the night before. You take all of your ingredients and put them actually, you could take a weekend and do like 14 little smoothie packages where you take your frozen banana cut in chunks. You put your frozen blueberries in there. If you take your Greek yogurt and freeze it in an ice cube tray, you can add 2 or 3 cubes of frozen yogurt. Honey, whatever else you want in there, and seal that up, put it in your freezer, and then in the morning you just take a half a cup to 1 cup of milk, dump that in. I don't use ice cubes because all this stuff is frozen. Blend it up and away we go with your recyclable stainless steel straw on your way to work.
Oh, bon appetit. We check in with root seller Sue Belkum every week to talk about Main Street Eats. And Sue, if people want to contact you or follow you, how do they do that?
You can visit my website at therootsellers.com. You will find all kinds of recipes and a connection to the blog Main Street Eats.
What's happening is next.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. We're celebrating our 10th year of radio on Prairie Public with a live taping, music, refreshments, and an exploration of the logic of jazz. Join me and my guest, jazz musician and philosopher, Mark Weinstein, for this free event on Tuesday, February 26th at 7 p.m. at the Empire Arts Center in Grand Forks.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Right. We have some new music today to introduce what's happening, and I'm joined by Christine McClellan, and she's in our Prairie Public Administration. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about what's on the calendar.
All right. Well, this first one is tonight. It's Romance Under the Stars at the MSUM Planetarium in Moorhead. Bring your sweetheart to the MSUM Planetarium for a special night under the stars. Take in the beauty of the heavens and learn about some of the romantic tales tied to the sky. Take a special tour of the cosmos and explore romantic constellations in our night sky. So that's tonight, 6 to 10 p.m., and it's $20 per couple.
Well, here's the 22nd annual API Gumbo Cook-Off. It's Saturday in Dickinson at the Ramada Grand Dakota Hotel. You can join them for a deep, dark, secret Cajun Bayou cooking at the 22nd annual American Petroleum Institute Gumbo Cook-Off. Team cooking begins at 11 in the morning. The public taste testing starts at 6:30 Saturday evening until the gumbo is gone, and you can dance at 8:30 to Thunder Road. It starts at 6:30 p.m. That's when the doors open, and you can start tasting. Goes till 12:30 a.m. It costs $10.
There's an ice fishing derby in Jamestown. This is at the Jamestown Reservoir, and it's on Saturday, February 16th, with more than $83,000 in prizes, including 2 Ice Castle ice houses and a Chevrolet Silverado. Fishing check-in takes place at Pelican Point Landing Campground on the northwestern portion of the Jamestown Reservoir. Again, this is on Saturday, starts at 9 a.m., goes until 4 p.m., and it's $25.
Community Rocks 2019 is Saturday in Minot at the Grand Hotel. Community Rocks is a Minot-based nonprofit dedicated to planning and delivering performance arts events to improve community well-being. It features a 30-piece string orchestra with horns, electric bass, and drums playing classic rock tunes from the 60s to the present. And this year's beneficiary will be the Magic City Discovery Center, a children's museum planned for North Minot. It runs from 6 to 11 p.m. on Saturday at the Grand Hotel in Minot. The cost is $45.
There is a Leon Williams concert at Trinity Catholic School in Dickinson on Sunday, February 17th. Leon Williams is an American baritone who has won top prizes in international singing competitions, and he enjoys a busy career performing as a soloist for symphonies, operas, and recitals. Again, that's Sunday, starts at 7:30 p.m., and it's $30.
Freezing for a reason. Polar plunges are scheduled Saturday in Fargo and Bismarck, and it will be cold. It'll be at the Delta Hotel in Fargo and the Elks Lodge in Bismarck. It's a fundraiser in support of Special Olympics North Dakota, which includes the law enforcement torch run for Special Olympics, friends, family, and everybody else. The Polar Plunge is for anyone who wants to participate in an extreme sport and have bragging rights, and you will, while supporting the Special Olympics program and its athletes. It's from 11:30 a.m. in Fargo and 3 o'clock in the afternoon in Bismarck. Again, it's Saturday. It costs $75 to enter. It's free to attend. And I think those people who are attending will get their free money's worth.
There's a Venus flytrap workshop. This is at Baker Garden and Gift in Fargo on Sunday, February 17th. Taking a workshop all about the Venus flytrap, the most well-known carnivorous plant around. The class will begin with a talk about carnivorous plants and what makes Venus flytraps so unique. Then you can create an insect-eating terrarium of your own to take home. So that's 1 to 2 p.m. Again, that's at Baker Garden and Gift, and it's $23.
Hello Horse Camp for Kids is Monday in Bismarck at Harmony Stables. This is a one-day camp for children ages 6 to 11 who want to gain more experience and confidence around horses. Campers will get to learn about horses and saddles and bridles. They'll practice horsemanship skills, meet new friends, and make horsey crafts. And, of course, they'll ride horses. Everything is provided at the Harmony Stables private indoor-outdoor riding arena. It's 8:30 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon on Monday, and the cost is $95.
Love Letters is a play at Theater B in Moorhead. This starts tonight and runs through Saturday, February 16th. Theater B's co-founders are wife and husband, too. Carrie and David Winterstein will play lifelong friends Melissa and Andy, who exchange notes through the years and occasionally struggle to express themselves. So it's 7:30 p.m. each night tonight through Saturday, February 16th, and the tickets range from $7 for students to $25 for adults and seniors.
The Polar Pile-Up is Saturday in Detroit Lakes at the Becker County Fairgrounds. You can join them for the first-ever Winter Demolition Derby. There'll be heated tents where you can warm up and buy refreshments. A bit of winter excitement for the whole family. The Polar Pile-Up Demolition Derby at the Becker County Fairgrounds on Saturday. It starts at 2 o'clock. It costs $10 for adults and $5 for kids.
The Derby for the Vets is at Fargo's downtown VFW Saturday, February 16th. VFW Post 762 and its auxiliary present the Lucky 7th Annual Derby for the Vets. It's an adult Pinewood Derby, small handmade cars that race along a metal track in the basement of the VFW. The opening ceremonies start at noon on Saturday, and racing will last about 2.5 hours, and the cost is free.
Well, here's my pick. It's Giving Hearts Day, and that's today, and you can do this online, or you can call your charity, do it by phone. If you're going to deliver a check, though, you have to bring it, dated today, and it has to be received today. Giving Hearts Day is a 24-hour giving event for more than 450 charities across North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota. Giving Hearts Day encourages the public to find a charity to love. And this year, gifts to Prairie Public will be matched by a generous grant from Newman's Own Foundation. Anyone with a debit or credit card and access to the internet can donate with a minimum donation of $10. Again, checks dated today and received today can be accepted by organizations. Giving Hearts Day is co-hosted by Dakota Medical Foundation, Impact Foundation, and the Alex Stern Family Foundation. Again, it's a 24-hour event. You can give up until midnight, and, it costs whatever you care to give.
My pick this week is the Full Moon Candlelight Hike. This is happening at Fort Stevenson State Park in Garrison on Saturday, February 16th. Come out and enjoy the full moon in February, known as the Snow Moon. You can cross-country ski, snowshoe, or hike a 1.5-mile candlelit trail. This is going to be 6 to 7:30 p.m., and the cost is free.
And that's what's happening.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, protecting families from fraud and scams, and helping more than 62,000 family caregivers who help make it possible for their loved ones to live at home. Creating real possibilities in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 14th. It was in 1898 when General W.D. Washburn decided to buy 113,000 acres of land in the northern areas of Burleigh and McLean County. The former senator and wealthy businessman wanted to resell the land to incoming settlers. In the meantime, he hired his friend and fellow businessman, W.B. McCumber, to manage the land and investigate possible coal deposits. In the spring of 1899, Washburn and McCumber set off from the Twin Cities to see how good the land was. On May 10th, they chose the highest hill in the area, a whopping 2,161 feet, to be the epicenter of their settlement. Washburn named it Wilton, after a town in his home state of Maine. On October 18th of the same year, he platted 4 blocks in Burleigh County and 11 in McLean County. However, he had to trade for part of this land with the Killians, a family of homesteaders who had arrived in 1887. He named 2 of the blocks, Louise and Minnie, after their daughters. Coal was soon confirmed in the area, and Washburn knew he would need a railroad to transport the precious cargo, so he began building a station in 1899. As the town grew, it gained a post office, published the Wilton News, and began construction for a general store and a gigantic 60,000-bushel grain elevator. However, one of the most exciting things to spring out of this new town was a baby boy. Edwin Wilton Owney was born on this date in 1902, making him the first child to be born in the town. R.C. Thompson, the town's young doctor, delivered him in a tar paper shack near the Northern Pacific Depot. Apart from being the first baby in town, the child was also the first baby Dr. Thompson ever delivered. Aside from a brief time in Chicago, the child grew up on his parents' farm until buying his own farm a mile to the north, where he lived out the rest of his days. But while Edwin Wilton Owney may be gone, his name is not. There are now over 150 Owneys living near Wilton, a testament to those early settlers. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity for 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to the Mexican border.
On Thursday's Morning Edition, a defeat over the wall did not stop the president from promoting it.
And it's a big wall. It's a strong wall.
And a teacher asked children to define love.
They ran off and grabbed the poetry paper and started writing, and they were coming out with lines like, love is when your dad comes home from war.
The latest news and the stories you'll talk about all day on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, experiencing World War I through its music is the title of a presentation Sunday at the Heritage Center and State Museum in Bismarck. History professor Perry Hornbacher says the music offers a unique perspective of the times. Dave Thompson will join us for our Friday news chat, and Matt Olin will review Alfonso Cuarón's Oscar-nominated Roma. We'll also remember the film career of actor Albert Finney. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.